Hello, everybody. This is Lenny Murphy. I'd like to welcome you to the Great Market Research Data Privacy Debate, defining the future of market research. At least we think that the topic is certainly applicable to that. We're sponsored by NetBase and by MicroPanel, so I wanted to thank them for pulling that together. And then also big thanks to our organizers, NewMR, Greenbook, MRGA, and NextGen Market Research. We've got six esteemed panelists today. Barry Ryan, who is the MRS Standards Policy Manager and Ephraim Rowe, Director of Policy and Communication. Tom Anderson, CEO of Anderson Analytics, founder and chairman of FTO, founder and chairman of NextGen Market Research, one of the early pioneers in social media research. Peter Miller, principal of Peter Miller Consulting, and one of the key guiding forces in writing the CASRO and ESMAR guidelines. Michaelis Michael, founder and managing director at Digital MR, who actually, this all was his idea. Ray Pointer, chair of the Festival of New MR, executive vice president of Vision Critical, author of the Handbook of Online and Social Media Research. And Adam Phillips, the managing director of Real Research, chairman of ESMAR's Professional Standards and Legal Committees. At this time, I'm going to turn it over to our moderator, who is Andrew Jevons. He's the EVP of Survey Analytics. Andrew is going to keep us all moving along. And Andrew, please take it away.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to the debate. I'm the moderator, as I term it, the ringmaster. Just to let you remind you to ask questions, you can ask questions via the GoToMeeting control panel. You'll see a section there called questions. Or if you'd like to put comments and questions on Twitter, we're monitoring the hash MRX Twitter tag, and we'll try and include anything that you say. We want to make this a really inclusive event. We've asked all the participants to make a quick opening statement. We want them to keep it to 60 seconds, 90 if they can't. So at this point, I'd like to ask Barry Ryan to start us off with his thoughts.
Thanks, Andrew. So William Gibson says that the future is already here. It's just not very evenly distributed. In many respects, it was researchers who saw the future first. 60 years ago, it was researchers who saw the power of data. They understood the responsibility that came with the collection and analysis of information and the harm that could be caused by its misuse. They chose to set down ethical principles that formed the basis of the first codes of conduct. In the late 1970s, in response to concerns with the power of computers to process personal data, the OECD arrived at much the same conclusions when they created the data protection principles. Those principles now have the force of law across dozens of jurisdictions. What were once voluntary restrictions established by researchers for themselves are now mandatory requirements for processing personal data. Further, the nature of data in the online environment engages a number of other obligations, including privacy, copyright, and the protection of children. So, market research codes should apply to social media research because in nearly all respects, they are simply restatements of the applicable law. We have a duty to our members and to research to create guidelines to advise researchers on their legal obligations. The direction of the MRS CASRO and SMR documents that we are discussing today is not only the right one, it is the only viable one as it reflects the external reality in which modern research must operate.
Thanks, Barry. Ray, what are your thoughts?
I start from a very similar position to Barry. I like to describe the guidelines he's talking about as dead white men's rules, because they were mostly drawn up 50 years ago, mostly by men who are white and who are now dead. And my concern is that in an attempt to say ever purer, organizations such as the MRS in particular, coming up with a narrower and narrower definition of market research. And that stuff that they define as market research really is market research, but it is becoming a shrinking part of the whole business. And what they say to us is, well, that's all right, just call what you do that isn't market research not market research. But we're getting to the point where most of what we do is not market research, and there is no future in that sort of direction. And I think that there is an arrogance if we set up the rules from the chattering classes, people like ourselves in this debate, rather than saying, let people decide what should happen to their data. People should sign up to various activities, and it should be driven by data owners and individuals, not by the chattering classes.
Thanks, Ray. Peter, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, my thoughts are, you know, this is all about, with respect to ethical codes, it's about the privacy and treatment of research participants, which of course are not respondents in this context. And if one looks at social media research, it really currently stands as the whole open web listening area. where informed consent really cannot be reasonably obtained, and the other major area, which are online communities referred to, is not MROCs, where informed consent can be obtained. The MROCs are interesting because there are methodological issues with bias due to the fact of exposure and the fact that somebody who would want to participate in a community about a product is probably a brand advocate. On the masking thing that's coming up, the guidance is the fact that the masking has to do with protecting the respondent, not particularly about masking comments in general. Research companies can and do engage in customer care, public relations, sentiment reporting, as long as they're clear about what the product is, who's doing it, and et cetera. These guidelines are going to evolve. They're not yet part of the ethical codes, technically. With respect to protecting privacy of respondents, it's really about doing no harm. Participants shouldn't suffer any consequences from having decided to do research. And we, of course, can't sell and cross the marketing line. The public's concern about privacy, a consumer advocate or a consumer may not take too kindly to someone taking comments, packaging them, and making a commercial product for sale. Also, casual users, as we all come across, probably our relatives and friends who say they're not on Facebook but do it in the context of Facebook itself, is really interesting. There are some also that believe that regulators may step in and explicitly act. We are seeing that. I can speak to the United States point of view on online behavioral advertising, where the expectation is that that particular behavior is going to be controlled. And this is a time of change. I mean, some have described it as a perilous time, but, you know, social media and how we use it is going to change. So it's about being careful we don't throw the baby out with the bathwater as we take decisions moving forward.
Okay. Michalis, as the instigator of all this, what are your thoughts?
Hi everyone. Well, Digital MR is a social media research agency that will, leaves from these market research using social media. So if these papers and these codes that are being discussed are implemented, we will probably go out of business in favor of the software development companies that do not abide by our codes, our ethical codes. So this is why we decided to publicly disagree with the codes that are out there. There are some misunderstandings and some, I think some of the associations are still thinking along the old paradigm, traditional research. They still talk about respondents when they mean people who post comments, and they compare, they're talking about picking in private gardens and through windows of private homes, when in reality we're talking about the public domain here and not password protected areas. So we definitely think that these proposals are going the wrong direction for market research agencies in the social media research space, and we hope that this debate will help adjust these codes to make it viable for research agencies in this space to compete with companies that do not abide by the codes of conduct of market research.
Good. Adam, what would you like to say? Hello, Adam. Okay. I'll move on and ask Tom, we'll come back to Adam in a moment.
Well, I think surveys have very little to do with the fast-moving social media and web analytics space. Do researchers need social media guidelines? No. Even if we did, they certainly wouldn't be drawn up by those who come from panel and survey research business and know next to nothing about these next-gen research techniques such as data and text mining. Ethical guidelines in the area of survey research were accepted because they actually made some sense, but more importantly, benefited research suppliers. Right or wrong, we were able to point to these standards as an excuse to keep the details of our product, typically panels, out of the reach of clients. What we research suppliers tell clients like P&G and Kraft is that we have a special relationship and ethical obligation to our panelists. In actuality, the reason these old guidelines have been so widely accepted is that most of us who work with panels would hate nothing more than to show these quite responsible clients exactly how badly the sampling sausage is made. While even this practice being called into questions by those such as Bob Lederer and clients demanding better transparency, at least it has served many suppliers well over the years. This would not be the case for even a moment with the current social media suggestions, which rather than helping suppliers is more likely to hinder smaller creative firms and preserve the status quo. Still, I highly doubt even Hanemichel Top 5 would agree to confine themselves to these outrageous constraints. True, these guidelines will mean almost nothing to the vast majority of research firms which belong to these research trade orgs, as they are involved mainly in CADI, qualitative, or survey research. Many of these do not have the technological or methodological skill set to leverage these next-gen techniques. And those few of us who do are already looking away from traditional market research and competing against a totally different set of companies who also have no interest in these traditional marketing research trade orgs. I see these guidelines as a naive attempt by some research trade orgs to remain relevant. They seem to have forgotten that research firms are not nonprofits and businesses that do what's in their best interest.
Okay, Adam, can we have your views now? Okay, I'm going to come back to Adam whenever he's around. Thank you, everybody. The question for the debate was, should we create guidelines which seeks to apply traditional MR ethics to social media research? And are we going in the right direction? There is a divergence of opinions here. So, Michalis, following on from what you said, you really don't feel that we're going in the right direction. What direction should we be going in?
I think we should take a step back and see, look at social media research for what it is, because traditional research typically deals with questions and answers. And in this case, nobody, when we're talking about web listening, which is what we object to, we object to having to mask the person who has posted a comment on the internet. That's our basic objection here. This is not a respondent. It's somebody who decided to go on the public domain and voice an opinion. And probably this person is glad to be quoted and wants to be wants his opinion to be heard. So I think taking a step back and asking ourselves, is this traditional market research? If not, what is it?
Thanks, Michalis. I'm going to ask Barry for a comment now, because the guidelines that the MRS came out with did provoke quite a lot of debate. Obviously, you have a different point of view.
Yeah, I mean, we're looking at this from our situation in the UK, where we have long-established and very well-developed data privacy laws. And both the SMR and CASR guidelines do say you can collect information from the public internet subject to relevant data privacy laws. So we wanted to explore that a bit further. I mean, this idea of public domain, public domain often is used in connection to in the area of intellectual property, for example, where information is without intellectual property rights. And I think there's an awful lot of the information that is out there, even before we look at data privacy, is not in the public domain. It is publicly available. You can read it and you can look at it, but it is owned by people. There are rights in the blog postings. There are rights in the photographs. BBC last week was forced to go and clarify, for example, that there is intellectual property attached to photographs on Twitter. So it's not entirely clear cut. And so what we want to do is actually get researchers talking about these issues, and I'm glad we're all here today, and thinking about what it means when we say public, what do we mean by public, and then, you know, what rights do we have to be able to look at this information, collect this information, use this information. I am sure there are ways to do this, like, to comply with the law, but I think researchers need to have that conversation to understand that, and we have a duty as a membership of the professional association to assist our members with that debate.
Okay, thanks. I'm going to return to Adam again, as we missed out his opening statement. Adam, can you give us your opening statement and comments?
Yeah, hi, Andrew. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Oh, that's brilliant. Okay, yes, my only statement is that I just like to come back to this idea that the ethical codes are out of date. When people are here that they're involved in research, what they want to know is, why do you want to know what I think and do, and why should I trust you if I tell you what I do? And I think that what the ethical codes do is they explain the purpose of what we're doing, which we're trying to understand, we're not going to try and sell you something, and that you won't be personally identified unless you give permission to identify you personally. That's the assurance we give. And that stood market research in good stead for a long time. The last time a transformational technology came along, it was telephone research about 40 years ago. We wanted to differentiate ourselves from people who were going to sell things to you through telesales. In every country in the world now, there is a need either for you to tell people that you're selling at the beginning of the conversation or that you have to say it within a limited period of time, like the first minute. And market researchers have a dispensation to call everybody, even if they're on do not call list. As we move into this new transformational technology, we need to have a way of explaining to people how we treat their data. It's not about limiting research. It's about giving people confidence that we're not abusing the trust they can place in us. And I think that these codes which we've put forward are a very good starting point and a good opening shot for the legislators and the public. Thank you.
Thanks. So, Tom, tell us why this is all rubbish.
Well, I think it's partly because of who was involved in setting up these guidelines. I mean, making sweeping statements about what is possible and what is not in terms of scraping and RSS feeds, they show a clear misunderstanding of the base technologies, for instance. And obviously, no companies are going to break the law. That's what we have laws for. So I think it's a lot of talk about something that that is not really relevant.
Well, thanks for that. I think now what I want to do is ask Peter why he thinks it is really relevant, because he's one of the foremost proponents of these kinds of guidelines.
Yeah, I think this is, my experience as being a technologist, I would suggest that I am aware of the current technologies. And also, from the consumer point of view, again, back to the statement of if somebody puts a comment into cyberspace about, they've had it with their four Taurus or something like that, I think it's a very different opinion they would have, an advocate might have, a regulator might have, from the point of view of saying, well, I'm fed up with this, and it goes back to the manufacturer in the context of customer care, versus somebody taking something and putting that into a product that they're reselling and they're making profit from. I mean, organizations like CASR and SMR spend a lot of time and involve a lot of people who are capable with respect to technology and current practices. And it also ties back to self-regulation. One of the things an old boss of mine said that, the solution you devise yourselves is going to be far superior from a solution that somebody imposes upon you. And particularly from the U.S. point of view and the Federal Trade Commission and their privacy report and their call for, something around preventing tracking around online behavioral advertising, they have been very clear in their report that they no longer see the distinction between market research and marketing, and the rules that are going to impact marketing are going to impact market research. So it's very important that we stay up to speed and to the point. I think this is going to evolve, and what's applicable now and what's applicable in the future is going to change. I believe it's ethical. Codes are going to change and evolve. And I think guidelines like this, which are guidelines, they're not part of these codes yet, are very important for how we formulate our practices.
Thanks. I'm going to ask Ray to answer the debate question, but also this question here from Pravin Shekhar. Do you really think that self-regulation is going to work in the new future? We all saw what kind of self-regulation News International did. Is this a viable way forward?
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, Pravin. Absolutely. Self-regulation has had its day. One of my other lives is for the last 28 years I've been elected politician. And I have to tell you that the public hate the fact that no-call lists don't apply to market research. They intended it when they were asked as a public. And so some of the very good ideas in the guidelines would be better as laws. So the idea that you shouldn't go into a community pretending to be somebody else. There's no point setting that up as a market research guideline. I mean, it should be a guideline. It should be something that would appall anybody on the panel to do. But actually, that needs the force of law for it to have any real credibility. Otherwise, the people who don't stick to that rule will just degrade the whole process. They will change the process. We need a much clearer idea of not whether something is in the public domain, but whether it's published. So if Robert Peston, a BBC journalist, writes a blog and he says that X, Y, and Z is happening, we would all very happily quote it. I write a blog, Tom writes a blog, and we're very happy that people quote it. Why do we think that we can decide that line when somebody's blog ceases to be a blog? Now, clearly in a private community, it's hands off. Clearly there are some people who are not aware that what they are writing is publishing. But that's the sort of area where we need to explore, because stuff that is published is free to use within the law, things like copyright and proper crediting and so on, but it is published. It's not just in the public domain. There's a difference between the two.
So, Barry, what's your take in terms of this issue of, you know, deciding what is in the public domain and what isn't and what should be constrained?
Yeah, I have a sort of a lawyer's aversion to using the phrase public domain, because I think Ray's point, Ray, the blog is published, but it is not in the public domain. It has copyrights that go with it. There is fair use. There are circumstances when you can quote it, where it can be reproduced. Attribution is not the same as permission. That's another point to remember in all this. And I think that's why we need to have this discussion. I think that's what we want to do when we went into some detail about copyright, saying there is a thing called copyright. It's going to apply in ways that you may not expect. It's going to vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. And here's the other thing. This is an international problem, which means there isn't one solution. It means there's 210 different solutions. Companies and researchers are going to have to be aware of what happens when they take on information from various sources and the location of where those people are. So if you're collecting information from someone in the UK, it's one thing. If you're collecting information about someone in Germany, it's going to be a very, very different issue.
Thanks very much. Michaelis, isn't this the point? Isn't the problem that we're trying to control the uncontrollable? This is an international community. No one set of guidelines or country can have dominion over it. You with us, Michaelis? Okay.
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we should all, and we all abide by the law of each country. And I what I'm going to say is that I hear all this, the discussion that is going on, especially from the side of the associations, and I think we're staying at a fairly high level in this conversation. I would like to hear a response from somebody about what's wrong with taking a tweet by somebody and publish it on a market research report for a client with their nickname attached to it.
So what you're saying is that we should be really looking at specifics. Peter, following on from Michaelis' comment, what's wrong with putting a tweet with someone's handle on it on a report?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things there. First, you know, the recommendations that are asking have to do with protecting the respondent from an embarrassing situation. For example, if you have a gamer community of 18 to 24-year-old males who, as part of that community and those blogs and various other interactions, tweets use four-letter words routinely and don't care to be embarrassed, there's no problem passing it along. If somebody walks into Starbucks having a particular bad day, about to get a divorce, and rants and rages against somebody and goes back and blogs, you know, including racial epithets or slurs about their sexual orientation, they might indeed regret that. The issue on the screen name really has to do with the fact that, and this is a big issue in privacy regulation you know, the ability now to basically to interpolate and to figure out who somebody is. So if the combination of the tweet and the combination of the screen name identify somebody, that's a real problem.
Okay, thanks a lot. An interesting comment or question came up. Do any of the proposals so far made make any sense? And I was just struck in Ray's opening comments. He was talking about the, you know, laws made by old white men. We're a bunch of old white men. Are we really plugged in enough to make any sense of these things? What do you think, Ray?
Sorry, I'd muted myself there. I think if we take standards, if you look at some of the people involved in those committees, you've got Pete Comley working on the ESMA one, Annie Pettit. I think you've got people who are connected. I think that we need to do a lot more research, and I don't mean commercial market research, but social research, to find out really what are the expectations. Michaelis makes a very interesting point about the tweets there, because if you quote somebody's tweet, you may run into copyright issue. You've also identified them as an issue, as an individual, and they can be traced. However, if using that information is not available to market researchers, then it ought not to be available to journalists and management consultants and direct marketing companies. There needs to be a level playing field. There is no point us setting a set of criteria that will only apply to us, so they won't help individuals, but they will hurt the industry.
This is Tom Anderson. Do you mind if I respond to Peter Miller's comment about Twitter?
I'll come back to you in a second. I've got to give Adam a chance, but you will be next, Tom. Adam, following on from that, I mean, we have a bunch of different standards. Are we really going to have to live in a world where we have multiple standards across different countries all over the planet? Isn't this just a pointless procedure?
Well, just 2 points. First of all, I'll answer that, but the point about what the Ray is making, I don't think that anybody's trying to stop people reporting data. What they're trying to do is to make it clear that if people are going to be reported in a market research report, they have the opportunity to say whether or not they want to be identified. And when we come to standards across many countries, I agree with Ray that the ideal probably would be to have a legal control, but SMR has members in 100 countries, and we simply are not going to have 100 you know, legal environments which are similar. So the issue for us is to try and set forward a set of reasonable rules which we can put forward to legislators, just as we've done with telesales and as we've done with polling, to try and make sure some basic rules are consistent around the world based around the way that we treat people that we're working with in research. We're not trying to stop researchers doing things which journalists can do.
Tom, let's have it.
Well, I think, you know, making a comparison to what somebody says at Starbucks to a tweet is insane. Twitter owns that data. It's RSS. It means it's being pushed to whoever's subscribing to that feed. Beyond that, Twitter, which owns the data, provides API to any developers to receive that data, and they even have aggregators who sell the data, such as Gnip. So you are. Allow people know that this is public information, and they don't really have a problem with it. This is just marketing researchers, again, assuming that the reason we would be doing this is for ethical considerations. Each time that we've done work with companies, either screen scraping or Twitter, customers think that more companies are listening than they actually are, and they want that. This is their opportunity to share with us what they think so that we can improve our products and services.
Thanks. I actually, before this debate, looked up the definition of privacy, the state of being private, retirement or seclusion, being free from intrusion or disturbance. I mean, isn't privacy in social media an oxymoron? Barry, what do you think?
No, it isn't. I mean, Facebook was created with actually quite a strong privacy policy, and then they went through a process of slowly lowering the barriers, or not so slowly, over a period of time. But what privacy is actually about is about creating a domain around oneself, about having control over what happens around you and to you, and in the modern world, about what happens to information about you. And we quoted a particular definition of privacy in our discussion paper, and it's about that element of choice that people choose what happens to their data and choose what they're doing with it. In the case of Twitter, I mean, it may well be wide open. Yeah, I mean, people, if you put large amounts of detail about yourself in the grotesque amount of detail, then, you know, you will have to live with the consequences, I think, as a practical matter. But the other point that's approaching from the other side is the way that privacy regulators address these issues, and the way that particularly European, German, regulations will define consent or people's expectations in a very, very narrow way. And we see it with Google in Spain, where they're being asked to pull search results because they relate to criminal convictions from 20 years ago, for example, or the data protection regulator in Schleswig-Holstein telling all companies to take down their Facebook pages and disable their Facebook links. On the face of it, this appears absolutely ridiculous, but it's the way the current law is being applied. Our members have to be aware of that. We have to tell them, we have to let them know that these are some risks that their businesses are being exposed to, and then they can make decisions about what they want to do going forward from that point.
Thanks a lot. Ray, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that when this is going to unfold, there was a court case in the UK only a few months ago, and Barry may have more information on this, where a woman's tweets were repeated, and she sued saying that they were private and this was an intrusion, probably under the Human Rights Act and the right to privacy. The court said, no, those are public and they will be used. However, I think that we, beyond law, we do have, and there is reference in all of the new guidelines. I mean, I'm not opposed to everything in the new guidelines. One is this sort of general harm business. So when you look at a tweet, there may be harm in using that.
Good point. And this
is a dangerous tweet, and you wouldn't want to pass that on. And I think that we are going to have to take on a duty of care, to use a terribly old-fashioned term, in terms of the data that we handle.
Yes, Peter, so we've got a question here, and it follows on from the current train of comments. Do you think that consumers really understand that their data and comments are public, especially on Twitter?
No, I think they don't. I mean, you know, back to this, you know, there are a lot of things that were raised about, you know, ownership of intellectual properties. One reads Twitter's terms of service, they say that they claim no intellectual property rights to material that they provide to Twitter, and it belongs to the person who makes the tweet. So yeah, that's a major issue. I mean, even I know a lot of technology professionals who should be aware, who actually do not read the license agreements and just hurry to run through them. I think people do not understand. And, you know, I think if we talk to people who are educated, they understand what the balance is. The people who are not educated about this are quite surprised in terms of what they might be sharing. There's also a generational difference, which was referred to with respect to old white men. You know, young people are very comfortable with sharing information in terms of getting value. And a core issue around the online behavioral advertising debate is that when people are posed the fact about, you know, when they learn about how this information might be shared and databased and what you know, what manufacturers or service providers may know about them, they're very happy when they get a related ad for a particular shoe they might be interested that's subsequent to a visit to Zappos. Yeah, people, I think, are generally very unaware.
Michaelis, so following on for that, I mean, should we care that people are unaware? Does it matter to researchers? And do you think there are generational differences in the concept of privacy?
There are generational differences, but it's not an issue of caring or not. It's like every other law or rule and regulation. If you break the law and you say to a policeman, oh, sorry, I didn't know there was a law against that, what will the judge respond to you? They would say, you should have known. Right? So if somebody comes out there and says, oh, I didn't know it was Twitter was a public place and I placed a private message to my friend and somebody took it, tough luck. I mean, this is ridiculous what we're discussing here. Mm-hmm. So we should be crippled. The market research agencies in the online space, you're suggesting that we should be crippled and we should let the software companies, you know, steal all our market share because of these ethical codes that don't make any sense. And you guys are still talking about respondents. I'm sorry, it may sound trivial, but it's not respondents. It's people who who voice their opinion in an unsolicited way. So let's try to move. It's a paradigm shift. Let's get there. How else can one articulate this? I don't know.
Adam, so you think it's, I guess you don't think it's fair to say that you're trying to cripple the global industry?
No, we're not trying to cripple the global industry. We're actually trying to keep the door open in the event that legislators start trying to push it shut. I don't think that any of the codes, certainly not the CASRA or the SML guidelines that we've put forward, are trying to stop researchers doing what anybody else can do. What we are arguing for is that the way in which we handle the data should be in a professional way, and that people should not be harmed, which is the point that Ray was making, by us scraping information off websites. As it happens, I think that more of the problem is going to be with research companies breaking the terms of use of websites where they're extracting data without permission from the site owners, and that is more of a problem for the industry than the issue, which, frankly, about passing data back, as long as you either, you know, as long as you get an agreement from your client, you're not going to go back and identify people, or that if you do, you explain why you're doing it, is not going to be a big issue if you read the guidelines carefully.
So, Tom, this is a perfect point for you. You really don't care, do you? Terms of use, they don't matter.
Well, before I answer that, going back to what Peter Miller said about, people not being unaware that this data is public, that's ridiculous. We did a huge segmentation about the entire online U.S. population, those who are on social media and those who are not, understanding why those who are slow adapters are slow adapters. And it's, in fact, because they feel uncomfortable with sharing things publicly. I think the common man is smarter than that. They quite well understand that everything is in the public domain that they say on Twitter. So going back to terms of service, yes, I mean, there are already many organizations like Web Analytics Association, the Text Analytics Summit, Sentiment Analysis Symposium, etc., which I'm very involved. Recently, I was on a panel at the Text Analytics Summit with over 600 text analytics companies. On the panel were large firms like Clarabridge, Attensity. And for the first time since I've participated now in 6 years, the question was asked, what about screen scraping and is it against terms of service? Every website now has it against their terms of service. The fact is, it has never been brought to court of law. So it was asked of the panel and the audience in general, are you worried about screen scraping in terms of service? And everyone said they were not. We haven't gotten a letter from a lawyer. When we do, we'll worry about it.
Thanks. Barry, so given that it was actually the guidelines that the MRS produced that provoked Michaelis and initiated this debate, aren't you really in danger of putting the UK research establishment out in the cold?
No, I don't think so. I mean, what our goal was to discuss the issues in an open way. I mean, what we wanted to do was to air the legal issues, the risks that businesses face. I mean, Tom gives a good example there of saying, you know, of individual businesses deciding whether or not something is a risk to their business. You know, terms of use, we'll worry about it when it happens. Well, it may or may not happen, but there are certain things that we know have happened, and that's what we wanted to bring to people's attention, particularly on the data protection front. There is ongoing and developing cases. I mean, Ray referred to the civil servant who was fired because of her tweets. That wasn't actually a court case. That was a ruling of the Press Complaints Commission, which the august body, which has got so much right. Particularly regarding News International, for example. But that was an interesting case because those tweets which were reported were actually set as being private. She approved each of her individual followers, and only her followers could receive her tweets, and they weren't searchable in the main index. So that was actually a slight wrinkle in that case, which I'm not sure the PCC quite considered correctly. But no, I don't think we're putting them at the cold. In fact, I think we are doing them a service by attempting to get them to think about all of the issues that are involved, particularly for companies who are looking at this as a new area and thinking this is where research is going, we want to go there. It's like, great, you should go there, but you need to understand these things and consider them when you are deciding how you want to run your business.
Right. So would you agree with that? I think that one of the issues may be that you can't worry about everything when you're running a business. Aren't we in that situation there?
Absolutely. I find myself somewhere between Tom and Barry on that point. I mean, there we can see some cases. The patients like me, Scrapegate, where Nielsen used a web scraper behind a wall and did massive publicity damage to our industry, really, and potentially to their clients. We should probably often put this in the context of, will it hurt our clients? Because had some members of that community sued for mental damage and torment, then the clients, because we none of us know, I don't think, who the clients were who commissioned the research from Nielsen, then they would be out there in the public area. But it's quite clear, right, that some terms of service are not enforceable. You know, the Wall Street Journal cannot say, you cannot read our newspaper and make decisions based on it. In the same way that when LinkedIn are publishing and when Facebook is publishing, then there is a limit to what they say you can't do. On the other hand, stopping you using a web scraper and burning up bandwidth probably is an issue. And I know that certainly Richard Scobel has had his use of sites restricted when he's used automated techniques because of bandwidth issues.
Thanks, Ray. I'm going to pose a question to Peter Miller from Pete Comley. It says, is it good enough to say we're breaking the law, but no one has been prosecuted yet? So who cares about the law?
Yes, Andrew, thank you. I mean, I think that, you know, lawyers deal with this stuff all the time. And if you talk to a commercial lawyer will tell you, here are what the risks are, I advise you, but ultimately the business owner is free to make a decision and to actually disregard the lawyer's advice. I can tell you from first-hand information that, you know, if one looks at the big four, you know, now the big three market research companies with the Ipsos-Cinnovate merger, you know, the lawyers are very astute. The leaders of those companies understand how important this practice is, and it's in their portfolio. You know, again, it's all about transparency in terms of what you're doing. But I think I can tell you that those lawyers are looking at this stuff very carefully, and from a business point of view, want to understand what the ethical issues are and are making decisions. You know, I mean, I'll leave that to anybody to decide that, you know, they're going to proceed and then deal with a lawsuit when it comes. I mean, that's a business decision, and, you know, a lawsuit could put you out of business and could negatively impact your brand. For example, the example that Ray just gave, that if something a research company does could not only impact them, but impact a major CPG manufacturer, you know, gives me, you know, significant cause for concern.
Thanks. Michaelis, so by advocating looser controls, aren't you putting the whole industry and yourself at risk of litigation?
I don't know how else to say it, Andrew. I repeatedly said that we are definitely abiding by the law. I don't think the position of SMR and the discussion paper of MRS is describing the limitations of the law. I think they are describing limitations that are unreasonable and have nothing to do with the legal situation. We understand the law, and we are responsible, and each company should be responsible. And we have the fiduciary responsibility to protect our companies from litigation. I don't think unethical codes, the way it's articulated in this case, is doing that. I think what these positions are doing is due to limited understanding of what this is. They're still talking about respondents. They're still talking about asking somebody for permission to publish their post in a market research report when this somebody has already given us the permission de facto by putting it on Twitter. So, yeah, I hope I have answered your question, but I'm not sure.
I just wanted to wrap up this and ask Adam. So, do you really think you can come out with guidelines that are workable, given the differences across the nations and given the inherent nature of social media, in that it is social, in that you abrogate some level of privacy when you use it?
Yes, I think we can. I mean, just to answer Michaelis' point, we don't talk about respondents, we talk about users. And I think that you may have read an old consultation version of the guideline, because a number of the issues he raises are dealt with in the latest version, which is up on our website. But coming back to the issue about working across a number of different nations, yes, I do think we can do this. And the reason for this is that, as we've all discussed, this area has evolved. It's a new area. It's an area where existing legislation doesn't really deal with it. And therefore, it is, in a sense, up to us to define what we regard as reasonable. And to do that, and I go back to the point I made originally about, you know, when somebody finds out they're part of research, they want to know, why do you want to know what I'm doing, what I think, and can I trust you if I tell you? And we need to be able to answer that question. If we can't answer that question, people are going to gradually close down and make it more difficult for us to observe what they're saying. So I think these guidelines give everyone the opportunity to explain exactly what we're doing. It's professional, and that it will be unfrightening to people who ask us what we do.
Thanks. We are beginning to come towards the end of the session, but I want to give everybody a chance to make a statement. I want to ask Tom, and I'm fairly sure what the answer will be, but it'll be interesting anyway. Should we proceed with this entire venture? Should a bunch of white men be debating this, or should we just, you know, go off and do something else?
I don't know. I hear a little backpedaling already by the trade orgs on this call, in terms of that these guidelines are just for guidelines and to open up discussion and educate us in terms of the law. That's not the kind of language that I see looking here, for instance, at the CASRO code, which was inspired by some of the others. They use terms like research must not permit personal data collected. And if researchers collect personalized social media data for other purposes, they must clearly differentiate this activity. Must. So, you know, even the case of Nielsen that was brought up, Ray mentioned that, you know, somebody could get sued. The fact is, in a litigious country like the United States, there would have been lots of lawyers lined up to take that case at 33 1/3% of the winnings had they thought there was any legal case to stand on there.
Thanks. So your control mechanism is litigation. Barry, where should we go with this debate now?
I think the control mechanism shouldn't be legislation, it should be trust. All that research has is the trust of the public and the trust of our would-be respondents or people from or about whom we collect personal data. Without that trust, and without the support of people who use and also who buy and use research services like clients, or be they commercial or be they governmental, research has no future. And as Adam has made the point repeatedly, this is about setting out our stall as a responsible sector, a group of people that can be trusted with information, just as we've managed to, the trust that we've managed to build and gain over the last 60 years should not be, could very easily be frittered away in the next 6 months. I mean, if the Nielsen case, for example, was to happen in the UK, they would be looking at the wrong end of a £500,000 fine from the regulator. It wouldn't require a court case, it wouldn't require litigation. They would just get a letter in the post saying, you know, do not pass go, please pay £500,000. And with their name goes the name of everyone else who's working in this sector. So that is the real risk. That if we don't get this right and do this properly over, you know, the next period of time, and this is an ongoing issue, what you have, you can lose very, very quickly. And that's why we all have to be able to work together and have these civilized conversations like we've had today about what we're going to do and how we're going to do this together.
Thanks. Michalis, what do you think? Should we go on with this?
I think we should become a little more educated about this new sector before we publish papers like this. I think it is helpful to help the industry to understand better, especially those research agencies that are just traditional, should they decide to enter social media research, to know where the associations stand and the market research industry. And I would keep it simple. I will agree with Tom and with Ray. I think Tom at some point said or wrote somewhere, do no evil. I agree with that. And I agree with Ray when he says we need to abide by the law. Let's not outrage the public and let's be open and honest. That's it.
Thanks. Peter, In terms of going forwards, do we have to get rid of the battle of the orgs, as it were?
Clarify that. What do you mean by the
battle? Well, we've got people with competing standards. Can't we all just be friends and get together and go forwards that way?
Oh, sure. We didn't mention the CASRO and SMR guidelines were built cooperatively, and there was a decision not to publish a joint guideline because of the fact that there are different codes, different ethical codes that apply to the different organizations. So you'll see, as we discussed, a lot of similarity. Again, the comment about this is evolving. This is a guideline. This is not party ethical code. We expect this to evolve. We have been working for coordination, and I particularly, working with CASRO, have done quite a bit with SMR about coordinating the efforts.
Thanks for that. And Ray, what do you think our next steps are? We've got to continue this debate. I think we need some more non-old white men involved.
I think you're right, and you've actually changed my original quote. It was dead white men.
I'm still alive, last time I checked.
But no, I think it's interesting that there are too few of the 21s, 24s, 25s involved. I think it would be good to hear. I think it would be good to research public's view. I think that there is it's an interesting bit of linguistic analysis between do no evil, which is, I guess, Tom's position, and do no harm, which would be my position. And there is actually some important differences between those. I am much more in favor of legislation than self-regulation when a group of people no longer dominate the industry. We don't dominate this industry. Therefore, we can't change the world, and we should recognize that. I do like corporate and social responsibility. I do like ethics, and I do like sharing information about what we believe the law to be, because that's going to be a fraught area.
Thanks for that. So, Adam, what are the next steps for SMR in this? Are you making any plans to include people who are basically younger than all of us?
We'd love to include people who are younger than all of you. One of the issues is that talking about regulation per se is not necessarily attractive to lots and lots of young people, but we are aiming to make this guideline much more accessible for debate. We're in the process of reorganizing our website, and I hope that over the coming months, so you will be able to engage with the debate with us, and that we will use what we get to produce a second version which encompasses the thoughts that people have put forward. Just one final thought is the MRS is not such a long way from the CASRO SMR position, but they are in a rather difficult legal environment, which is the European legal environment. And when Ray says, you know, he'd like everybody to conform to the law, if we have to work in a world where every country has slightly different laws, it's going to be very, very difficult to run any kind of online research business, or indeed any online business.
Thanks a lot, Adam. And as fate would have it, it's Tom comes up as the last in the contributors. Now, you and I, Tom, sparred quite heavily on LinkedIn about the Patients Like Me website and Nielsen's actions. Why weren't they evil? You say do no evil. How does scraping information off a website devoted to a particularly pernicious set of illnesses come as okay?
Well, first of all, they gained access. Anybody who wanted to get into that forum seemed to get access. So it wasn't as private as it was made out. So the fact was they were in there scraping the data, and then they used it for a research report to help pharmaceutical companies, which help people. So how is that evil? I don't understand. The media likes to make a big deal out of this, much bigger than what we found through our research the average citizens think. They understand it's public, but, you know, it sells more newspapers or gets a few more views if you use some Big Brother type language. We never see this among the general population.
Thanks a lot. At this point, we're heading towards a wrap up by Lenny in a moment. I'd like to thank all the panelists and everybody who's asked questions and all the attendees for taking part. We are going to deploy a couple of polls over the GoToWebinar system. Here's the first one coming up. And so now I'd like to hand over to Lenny.
Thank you, Andrew, and thank you, everybody. Boy, I'm not sure what there is to wrap up on that, though. Two definitely opposing viewpoints. That's probably a surprise to anybody that we didn't reach commonality or a sense of accomplishing this divide. But I think what we did do is certainly explored the topics more fully and establish a great dialogue going forward. I think that was absolutely the intention, was to bring some of the folks involved here and create a forum for conversation. There's certainly lots that's being talked about on Twitter. There's lots of blogs that are being written, even as we speak, I'm sure. And this debate will certainly continue. Would encourage everybody to vote on the poll, read the guidelines that are being proposed, work within your organizations. If you're a member of ESOMAR, CASRO, MRS, or any of the other trade orgs, work within them. If you have a voice, make it heard. I would say from a personal standpoint, yeah.
You should see the first results of the first poll.
Yep. Thank you, Ray. I do see those. So the first results, we've got, should we create guidelines for social media research, would seek to apply existing market research ethical codes and guidelines? 54% yes, 25% no, 21% don't know. So just barely a majority saying yes, but that is certainly interesting. And here is our second poll. Are the current proposals, those proposed by MRS, CASRO, and ESOMAR, heading in the right direction? If everybody will please vote quickly.
We're going to give that 50 seconds in total.
Yeah. We've got, what, just shy of 300 people on, Ray? So a healthy sample, at least. Now, for those who asked questions and we didn't get to them, encourage you to reach out to all of us individually if you need to, or continue the conversation on Twitter, or as I was saying just a moment ago, engage with CASRO, ESOMAR, MRS. And here's our results. Are the current proposals heading in the right direction? 34% yes, 24% no, 41% don't know. I suspect that don't know is because you haven't had a chance to read them yet. So I would encourage you to go back and read them. So I think that's really it. This debate was healthy. It was something that needed to happen. Let's continue it on. Certainly pay attention to what's happening with MRGA, Green Book, NGMR, and NewMR. I'm sure other opportunities to do similar things like this will arise, and we'll certainly let everybody know. Thanks again to our sponsors, Survey Analytics, MicroPoll, and NetBase. And thank you to all of our attendees and all of our panelists. That's it. Thank you, everybody. Have a great day.